Diana is the author of three previous books, Finding My Voice, about her early life and her struggle with spasmodic dysphonia, Life with Maxie, about her dog, and Toward Commitment, co-written with her late husband, John. Diane Rehm, very much a pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so, so much.
The book begins at what John hoped would be the end. He just got fed up, and what did he decide to do then?
He decided that since there was no other way, since, as you correctly state, the laws of Maryland do not permit death with dignity, the only option he had was to stop drinking water, stop eating, and stop taking medicine. Now, you probably know that without food, you can exist for quite a long time, 45, 50, even 60 days. Not so without water. Water feeds the organs, and without water, the organs die quickly. John died after 10 days, and my sadness was that we did not live in Oregon and could not move John to Oregon because, of course, Jeff, you do have a residency requirement. You do have to be declared within 6 months of death, which actually John was. But nevertheless, he had to suffer through that 10 days.
How thorough had been your discussions back and forth about what to do when the end came?
Oh, my gosh. We've been talking about it for years. You know, my parents died when I was 19. My mother was only 49. She had liver cancer. My father died 11 months later of a broken heart. John's father lived on a farm by himself, and because of diabetes, developed diabetic retinopathy, which meant he could no longer drive, he could barely see. He took his own life. John's mother at 92, because she had terrible back problems and could barely walk, ultimately took her own life. So death was a discussion we freely had in our family, and John and I had promised each other we would help when the time came. Now, John was 6 years older than I, and because he had longevity on his side, I really thought I would be the one to go first. But then poor guy developed Parkinson's disease, and it was a terrible battle for about 8 years.
Yeah, you weld the tale without getting into really gruesome levels of description what he went through. I mean, just how frustrating it was to him to lose his own mobility over time and his own ability to care for himself.
Exactly.
So having gone through all that, you certainly discussed the idea of him withdrawing and saying, that's it, no more food, no more water. Having had that discussion, though, did it make it any easier when the moment came?
No. I think, you know, to lose a man, a spouse, a loved one that I had been with for 54 years. I mean, it is the first time in my entire life when I've been alone, except for my dog, Maxie, who is still with me. But I went from my parents' home to a very brief first marriage, and then life with a roommate for about a year. And then when she went off to California and I married John, I'm living again with someone. So this is the first time in my life I've been alone. It's a very, very different situation.
I'm surprised at the amount of review that you and John had toward the end, Diane, talking about your marriage. How constructive was that?
Oh, it was so important. Oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, the day after we had had this long conversation with John's doctor, with our daughter in Boston, who is also a physician, and our son, who was at the time provost at Mount St. Mary's University, and I in the room with John, and John said, I am ready to die. And, you know, our daughter said, but Dad, we can provide you comfort. And he said, I don't want comfort. So we all left after quite a while. And then I came in the next morning, really not knowing what his decision was. And I had brought with me a photograph album I had made years before of his life from childhood, from babyhood, on through graduation from Friends Seminary in New York. And I sat on the bed with him, and we began going through those photographs. And I said, have you made up your mind? And he said, well, I have had no water. I have had no medication. I have had no food. And I feel great. It was as though, Jeff, he had finally taken his own life back into his own hands.
It's actually a very comforting moment to have that related in the book as well. The book is called On My Own. The author is our guest, Diane Rehm, the Diane Rehm. We'll come back and talk more with Diane and take your phone calls and emails down the hour when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Diane Rehm, which I never thought I'd get to say, but the Diane Rehm of the Diane Rehm Show that precedes the Jefferson Exchange here every day on this station is our guest, talking in part about her illustrious career, which is coming to a close with her departing from the Diane Rehm Show later this year. And we're also talking about her new book, On My Own, about her husband John's death a couple of years ago from Parkinson's disease and ultimately from his decision not to take in any more food or water or medication. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take your calls down the hour, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Diane, you do take us back to your first days with John. Where did the two of you meet?
I was his secretary at State Department. And John was an attorney in international trade doing work for my boss. So he would frequently come into our office and, you know, we began talking. He had a very loud voice. And I kept thinking, my goodness, didn't this man's mother teach him better manners? You know, you could hear him coming all the way down the hall. But in any case, I had some books on my desk that I was reading, the essays of Alfred North Whitehead, the Brothers Karamazov, and of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham. And I think John was just fascinated that a secretary would be reading these books. I had never been to college, whereas John had a wonderful education and then on to law school. And the other thing that sort of motivated us to speak with each other a fair amount was we both played softball. He was a pitcher for the men's softball team. I was second base person for the women's softball team. So we, at one point, made a bet that summer on the World Series, and I happened to win the bet. So John Rehm took me out for our first dinner, and it kind of went from there.
So I guess it's a good thing you have good baseball sense.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You know, despite his magnetism, he apparently was quite the loner. You acknowledge it. He acknowledged it as well during his life. But people did like being with him. What made John so magnetic?
I think he just had this very warm, kind, outward personality. He had lots of friends around him who really turned to him for friendship and for meaningful conversation. But John always was a very private fellow. And when we got together, I mean, you know, in those early days of reaching out and beginning to know each other and beginning to share things, I mean, that was just beautiful. It was a wonderful courtship, a wonderful time to share and to be together. However, the more after our children were born, I think John's professional life began to be so demanding. He became the youngest assistant legal advisor for economic affairs that State Department had ever seen, and then went on to a White House position as the first general counsel for the U.S. Trade Representative. And that work became so demanding, Jeffrey, that at times he would leave at 6 o'clock in the morning and not return until midnight, 1 a.m., and then off he had to go to other countries. And it really created problems, and I think that I, at home, with two children, it just became difficult. And I think that the more demanding I became, the less willing he was to participate. He was a loner, and marrying, perhaps, was even something he might not have done had he and I never met.
Yeah, I was so struck by that late conversation, late in his life, though, that, you know, maybe he would have been better off not getting married. That's a hell of a thing to say to the person you've been married to for 50-plus years,
but
it made sense.
But then I would have missed out on you and David and Jenny. So, I mean, I knew his heart at the end. I wish I had been more mature. I wish we had both been more mature in our understanding of the other's needs. I'm far more gregarious. I'm far more involved with people around me. John, as I said, was much more of a loner. He used to say that silence and being alone was like a drink of water.
Wow. Diane Rehm's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her most recent book is On My Own, about the death of her husband, John, from Parkinson's disease and his decision to hasten his own death. That was just a couple of years ago. When you talked about John's career and how consuming that became, what was it that propelled you out of the house and into the offices of WAMU?
Sheer luck. Sheer luck. And, you know, it was so close by. A friend told me one day, just happenstance, that she had been volunteering at this tiny little radio station on the campus of American University, which was less than a mile from where we lived. And, you know, this little light bulb went on in my head. My kids were about 13, 14, and 11 by then. And so I was beginning to think, I wonder what lies ahead for me. These kids are not going to need me for very long. They're going to go off on their own. What am I going to do? So when she mentioned this radio program she was working on, honestly, if you could have seen me, a light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, gee, I wonder if I could do that. And I asked her whether she'd be good enough to talk with the host and see if I could come in for an interview. And indeed, I did go in for an interview, and the host said, fine, come in next Monday, and you can begin your volunteer work with us. And you know, Jeffrey, it was like apprenticeship. That's what it was. And that is, I believe, what we need more of today, apprenticeship. And of the many producers that I have hired since then, many of them have been volunteers first. But on my first day the following week as a volunteer, I was met at the door by the manager of the station, who told me that the host was out sick and that she, the manager, was going to have to host the program. And would I be good enough to come into the studio with her and help conduct the interview?
Wow.
So the very first day I showed up at WAMU as a volunteer, I was on the air for 90 minutes with a representative of the Dairy Council.
You must have asked some great questions about milk and cheese and stuff, though.
Well, precisely, because, I mean, I had been a homemaker for all those years. I knew that people were saying that cheese and whole milk and meats and things that the Department of Agriculture was pushing were not really very good for us. So I was able to ask some good questions. And, you know, I was a volunteer for 10 months, and then a position opened up as associate producer. I got that, and I was here at WAMU for 2 years as a producer, then went off to do some television and some other kinds of radio for the Associated Press and Physicians Radio Network. And then when this job opened up, I applied for it along with about 100 other people and was lucky enough to get it.
Well, I think we were lucky, too. Diane Rehm is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you know her well from her own show that precedes ours every day. Her new book is called On My Own, about the last days of her husband's life and her days since that time. Here's some calls. Paul in Grants Pass, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Welcome to Oregon, ma'am.
Thank
you. If you're on the phone, I assume you are, but come out and visit us one of these days. I did not realize that the focus of the interview was going to be on the book. The one question I have related to the book and the death of your husband, when he chose to starve himself and to deny himself water, were any issues raised at all with the authorities in your jurisdiction? I do have a couple of follow-up fan questions because I am a big fan.
Okay.
But was there any issue raised?
Let me answer that. The doctor said in that conversation, I wish you would not make this decision, but if you do, I promise to support you. And John then asked, will I be in pain? And the doctor said, absolutely not. I will ensure that you are not in pain.
And Paul, your other questions?
These had to do with your program. Three questions. The first question: who is the most fascinating guest you ever
don't
interviewed?
Ask me that.
Yeah.
And the second
one, of course, is who is the most disturbing guest?
Don't ask me that.
Fair enough. Fair enough. That's a fair answer. I've done my share of radio interviews too. And then finally, what do you think about the near term shape of the American polity?
Oh my goodness. I think this is the wackiest election process I've ever seen. I can only hope that reason prevails in the electorate. And by the way, I am in Portland, Oregon, every 4 months for my voice treatment at OHSU. So I know that part of Oregon quite well and love being there. So thanks for the invitation.
And thanks for the questions, Paul, too. So, all right, so we're not going to ask again the favorite interviewee or the least favorite or anything like that, but let me ask, if you have the dreams that I sometimes have where you get in the room and you have no notes, you don't even know the person you're talking to, and you have no idea what to talk about.
That has never happened.
Really?
For some reason, you know, I have 5 wonderful full-time producers and 2 part-time producers, and I am always prepared.
A friend of mine calls those newsmares when I dream of those things. She has stuff like that, too.
Newsmares, that's good. That's good. I like that.
Here's a call from Aralee in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Diane Rehm.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, this is Marilee. What I wanted to talk to you about is from county to county, things change as far as getting help when you have a member of the family that needs home care. And when my brother died, or before he died, there was nothing available to him where he could have any in-home care unless he let go of just about all his assets. And another county, it would have been different. I was put in the position, him living in Aberdeen, Washington, and his children living up in Seattle area, and me not being able to drive very well and having an illness of my own where it was hard to get him to hospitals in different places when he was dying. And he wanted me to help him stop taking any medications, and I didn't really know, but I remember trying to get him to the doctor at that time. And I did, and the doctors told me to leave, that it wasn't good for me to try to do this without the help of his children, who lived in Seattle and had excellent jobs from his first marriage. I had to leave, but I think what I'm trying to get to is the fact that over the grieving period, there's been a tremendous amount of opening up in me because of my deep pain with not being able to be with him during that period of time when he was dying. In a rest home, had to let go of his house, everything that was something that was important to him in his life before had to go. But he's come to me in dreams and pretty much said to me, it's okay, you have your life now, take care of yourself.
All right, Marilee.
You know, I have been traveling around the country and am continuing to travel around the country for my book. And I must say, there is no end to the stories of suffering and loss. And the attempt at caregiving and the difficulty of finding help for caregiving and the grief one feels when the loss, however long or short the illness has been, finally comes. There's something that people sometimes talk about, the word closure, I wish, is a word that we're banned from thinking about grieving. I don't think we ever, ever stop grieving in some place in our hearts. That, you know, John will always be there for me. I talk to him every day. And people ask if he talks back, and he does. I mean, I think it's because we did have such a deep, deep bond. And it continues. And I'm so glad it does. But every person has a story, no question.
They do indeed. We're learning more about Diane Rehm's story. Her book is On My Own. I should point out, by the way, that the Dear Scoop letters that you write to John after his death are some of the most moving parts of the book. Diane Rehm, our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her and take more of your phone calls and emails when the Jefferson Exchange returns in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Diane Rehm, the Diane Rehm of the Diane Rehm Show that precedes the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service every day. She'll be walking off that stage after the election later this year, date to be determined, but she also is the author of a new book about the final days of her husband John's life. He had Parkinson's disease and opted in the middle of 2014 to stop receiving food and water and medicine. The book is called On My Own. Diane Rehm is our guest on The Exchange, and you can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about the great differences in the way that people grieve. And Diane, you tell us in the book that you did go to a grief support group and were surprised to find yourself angry. Well, who's the anger directed toward?
Well, not quite angry, but really sort of feeling as though I didn't belong there, that my grief is my own, and everyone, as I said earlier, has some story in their lives that really is profoundly moving and of importance to them. But I also found that I was glad to leave, that I feel as though my grief is my own. My grief is not what I really believe in talking about publicly. My grief is within my heart, and that's why I talk to John each day. But my grief is also anger that John was not able, as those people are in Oregon, to receive that blessing of pills or liquid or some formulation that would have made his passing easier. I think 10 days of who knows what was going on within him, because after the second evening, John fell asleep, and I couldn't talk to him anymore. He just passed right into that sleep stage, and for the next, 8 days, that's how he was. And that just makes me so sad, especially because on that last night, on the ninth night, I slept on two chairs next to him my little dog Maxie on my stomach. And of course I couldn't sleep. So I had my iPad with me. And at 2 a.m., that's when I got up and started writing what I was feeling, what I was seeing, what I was experiencing. And that became the start of the book. I wanted to go to a grief counseling session to hear how others handled their own grief. But I wasn't angry at them. I wasn't angry at myself. I understood their need, but I also realized that I did not belong there. And though I participated equally as fully as anyone else, I left feeling relieved that I did not have to go back. But Jeffrey, everybody's different. I think grief counseling centers can be wonderful. My hope is that my book spurs discussion about the right to die, so that as Oregon and Washington and Vermont and California have done, eventually there will be a countrywide move toward the right to die and allowing individuals who have really reached a point where they think their life is no longer worthwhile, that as John could no longer feed himself, he could no longer walk from the bed to the bathroom, he could no longer bathe himself. I mean, he just felt he did not wish to fall into further indignity.
We have another call here for Diane from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Diane Rehm.
Hi. Well, Diane, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
This is my dad's story. Am I here?
You are.
Yeah. This is my dad's story, except he didn't decide at the end, but I know he thought about it. I did research a little bit of this, and the suicide rate is, despite the news media, it's not kids, it's not teens, even though that's awful. It is the older age group. And I just want to know, I know it was on my dad's mind, but what would I have said if he considered it or any of the thoughts you have, Diane? Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it.
I'm sorry. I did not understand the very last part.
I think he was asking what things he might have said to his father, either let him know it was okay or dissuade
him.
Well,
here's what I would say to everyone who's listening. Whether you're the parent or whether you're the child at whatever age, it's time for us as a country, as families, to begin to discuss what it is we want at the end of life, as the end of life approaches. I am 79 years old. I will be 80 in September. I will step away from the microphone at the end of this year. This may shock you to hear this, Jeffrey, but if I were at home and I had a stroke or if I had a heart attack, I would not call 911. Because I would not want to end up in a hospital intubated with tubes coming out of my arms and in this sterile environment. I want to die at home. I want to have my family around me. I want to go when I am ready. And maybe this gentleman's father is ready, and he is feeling as though he wants to go. At the same time, I totally support those people who want palliative care forever and don't want to think about dying, but want to be cared for no matter what happens. And I also support those people who believe that the only time to go is when God says it's time to go. I, too, am a person of faith, but I want to go when I am ready to go. What I hope my book does is to spur this conversation among families. It's time we became less death averse as a country.
We do get spooked by that subject, no question. Here is another,
absolutely.
Here's another call from Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Diane Rehm.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Diane, I would like you to know that I have two atomic clocks that are atomically regulated to be absolutely accurate. They are both set for 6:57 in the morning, and they both go off at slightly different times. I have listened to you for years, decades, and I grieve your passing. Thank you so much for being an intelligent and confrontational, no BS, the best talk show host on all of NPR.
Thank you so much. That's very kind of you.
So was there a particular moment that allowed you to say, okay, I'm ready?
I don't know what that moment's going to be. Mm-hmm. I have no idea, except if I feel as though I can no longer contribute, I can no longer care for myself. Those two things would make me think seriously about finalizing mm-hmm. my life.
Okay, I meant your career, but we'll go with that too.
Now, with my career, are you asking why I am ending it?
No, there's no question about why, but I mean, I just wonder if there was a moment when it became clear to you, it's like, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to get to
yeah,
get out of this business.
And it was the idea of turning 80. Somehow, I feel as though I've had the privilege of having that two-hour slot on radio for 37 years. It's time for a younger voice. It's time for fresher ideas. It's time for others to have a chance to create something new, something exciting for public radio. And, you know, I'm not a selfish person, but I've had this spot for a long time, and now it's time.
Your diplomacy has been stellar over the years. I still marvel at the time that someone called Grover Norquist a traitor and you stopped the call right away. Have you had to squelch your own feelings a lot, though?
Well, right now, you know, I cannot speak on the air as freely as I would like about my beliefs on the right to die. I do feel as though listeners should be thoughtful and should be courteous when they call. I ask the same of guests, so I expect no less of callers. And I think that that's why we get civil conversation on this program. It sounds as though you do the same. I just think the craziness in our world is in part because of the craziness on the air, the screaming, the hollering, the name-calling, the ridiculous charges and counter-charges, and people screaming screaming over one another. Who wants to listen to that? Not I. And so that's what I have modeled or tried to model on the program. And I think we've had some really, really interesting discussions because of that.
You describe in the book the Washington of the 50s as a relatively quiet city. Was there any way you could have possibly known back then it would turn into what it's become today?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it surprises me every day, especially, Jeffrey, where traffic is concerned. Every now and then I have to go downtown during rush hour to speak or something. I mean, I try to avoid that at all costs. The traffic in this town is now unbelievable, and the traffic, the discourse on Capitol Hill is unbelievable. I shake my head when I hear the kind of language coming out of politicians' mouths these days. Too bad. Changed so much.
Has indeed. 7 more months of it, though, and then we have the election at last.
Indeed.
The book is called On My Own, Diane Rehm's book about the latter days of her husband John's life and the absence of death with dignity laws where he would really have preferred to use them. Diane Rehm, it's been as much of a pleasure as I would have expected. Thank you so much.
Thank you for every moment.